Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, everybody. It's Sunday. Welcome to this edition of The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's. In studio is Jack Inslee. Jack, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, a very, very, very exciting weekend. I'm so excited. I woke up this morning and I came up with a brilliant marketing scheme, Jack.
For radio?
Our 9 millionth Facebook like gets a free ham. So we're 9 million away, you know, we're just under, around 8.8 million away. Just log on, like us, you know, but the 9 millionth gets a free ham. I'm excited about it. Jack?
Yeah, not bad.
Okay. Well, we have a great show. We have Zach Kell, the chef of Community Food and Juice, and Shauna Pacifico, chef of Back 40 and...
Frequent. Back 40 West.
Oh. We broke it here. That's all we got. Now we can get no more info about the new Shauna Pacifico Peter Hoffman restaurant. But
also
it's good. I learned a lot.
Co-host of The Main Course, Shauna Pacifico.
What's that?
Also a frequent co-host of The Main Course.
I haven't been a co-host in a while. You haven't invited me.
Well, you've been in Brazil the whole time.
Oh, yes. That's what I do. I spent all my time in Brazil.
Yeah, you're there most of the year now, right? So, well, this is a very exciting week in review, because Jack, I hear you've selected something relating to Barack Obama, right?
That's my news music. I need news music first. Okay.
It's, I kind of like that to play during the entire duration of the
Yeah, right? Make the interviews more intense. Did you watch the State of the Union?
Yes.
Yeah, what did you think?
I think, you know, he gave a real populist message, you know, and he's going to stick to his guns. And I like him. So, you know, I think he did a good job, like he's been doing for 4 years.
There was a cool shout out for dairy farmers, so I'm going to let that roll.
Now, there's no question that some regulations are outdated, unnecessary, or too costly. We got rid of one rule from 40 years ago that could have forced some dairy farmers to spend $10,000 a year proving that they could contain a spill because milk was somehow classified as an oil. And with a rule like that, I guess it was worth crying over spilled milk.
Very, very funny. So I'm going to bring everyone in here. Zach, what do you think about that?
I think that there are a lot of ridiculous regulations, less on the dairy market, but more on like organic and a lot of these buzz terms that are coming out that kind of tend to damage a lot of local farmers that can't afford to be certified or go through the steps, but take, you know, sometimes better measures to make sure that their stuff is truly local and organic. And I think that's something that we definitely need to look at.
Very interesting. What you say reminded me, you know, I think the biggest kind of loss of culture that comes through corporate culture is the disempowerment of the middle management from being able to run their kind of independent fiefdoms of, you know, quality relationships and trust building, you know, versus a single corporate mentality that just, you know, buzzes in a low monotone through the entire, you know, A to
We're
Z,
headed
top
in that direction.
To bottom.
Yeah. It's a scary place to be.
You know, just think of regional, like, fast food restaurants. If chefs at those restaurants were, you know, allowed to be independent chefs, you know, and make the burger mixture themselves, I mean, all of a sudden you would have millions of independent restaurants, you know, with creative people.
Yeah, well, that's work out that way. It's all, you know, controlled. I mean, you can go to, I was talking about this last night at dinner with my cousin who's visiting from Florida, who was so excited to eat here. And we ate crispy pig head at Ma Pesh. And she was like, I'm not going to eat pig head. And the waitress actually convinced her. And she was like, I would never eat this. I'm like, yes, because you eat at Olive Garden. Like, you eat at Red Lobster. Like, they don't serve you that. Like, they actually do serve you things like that, but they don't tell you what it is in a much grosser way. So, yeah.
Yeah, we got to be adventurous, you know. But I think the main issue with something like franchise restaurants is that if you allow chefs to do stuff like that, you're going to seriously cut into your profits. And that's like a big corporation issue, you know. That's why it's nice to work within a group. I mean, like someplace like Community, which is a larger restaurant. So I have a lot more opportunities to bring my food costs down, which allows me opportunities to work with guys like you and bring in higher end products, you know, and be able to really work with them and source them from local things. But if you're talking about $2 burgers, you know, it's like you need to buy 20,000 pounds of ground beef to make that something that's actually profitable. And if you have your own personal chef making his own mix sourced from where he wants to, there's no way you're going to be able to turn that kind of money.
It's true. The dollar menu cannot be competed with, but the cost of a quarter pounder with cheese, which is independently, if you just bought it alone as a sandwich, is what, $3.89, something like in that ballpark. Then all of a sudden, you know, if a relationship could be built with like a farmer's market network that will deliver, you know, between 2,000 and 6,000 pounds, there always would need to be a backbone commodity, you know, backup in case this wouldn't work, or, you know, in case they sold it all at market. But, you know, I still maintain that the cost differences are not as vast as people make them out to be. Although the dollar menu, I mean,
no,
that's,
I mean,
that's too hardcore.
I agree with you. It's just going to be hard to convince a bunch of CEOs of that. So,
well, there was a guy, Poilin, this baker in France, who, when he expanded his old bakery, rather than do a top-down system, because he was a big producer, he had one massive fire in the this massive hearth, and radiating out of that hearth, like rays from the sun, were independent baker teams, each of which made his standard breads, but, you know, with kind of charming inconsistencies between each one. Nonetheless, he would stamp each one with the big P to be like he signed off on it. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of like that managing scheme versus, you know, top people you never even really meet. Well, Jack, what's next?
Yeah, this is kind of a detour, but Katie Kiefer kind of had spokesperson for commodity meat, you know, and she brought up antibiotics to him, and it's really funny to see how he got all wormy and uncomfortable. So I want to play the clip of him.
That the concern around the use of subtherapeutic antibiotics is justified, and if so, how is the cattle industry responding to that?
Boy, that's a good question. The vast majority of antibiotics used in feedlots are not the same products that are used on humans. So there's kind of a miscommunication there, I guess. Does it create problems downstream? I've seen research that proves that it does, and I've seen research that says it has almost no effect. I think we're really too early in the research part of this whole controversy to make a definitive.
Yeah, how's that for an answer?
That's the best
answer.
Did
I hear miscommunication?
That's always the best answer. It's too early to tell what's going to happen.
And
it's
the antibiotics that we use on humans.
No. Oh, thank God.
That's
good. We just ingest the food.
They use that argument in the opposite direction, too. The GMO people, push it through, you know, and just say, well, no one knows.
What is the difference between antibiotics and anti-therapeutic antibiotics?
Subtherapeutic antibiotics.
That's a great question. Jack will actually look that up, maybe.
Yeah. Well, Katie Kiefer will be here in a few minutes.
Oh, yeah, just bring Katie in.
Bring Katie in. She'll
be like, Pat, move over. No, very, very interesting. I mean, it just seems like people know what people know. It's just very hard to say. I would just hope it's like being, you know, it's like black and white. There's good food supplies and questionable food supplies, like the whole center of the supermarket. You know, the aisles are where the frozen vegetables, fresh vegetables, that's good. Inside, that's mostly bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I don't necessarily see what an issue with using antibiotics on cattle is. I mean, growth hormones, steroids,
the issue about using antibiotics is the fact that they have to use the antibiotics because they're raised in such confined,
squalor,
disgusting grossness that they have to feed the animals antibiotics just to get them to walk to the slaughterhouse.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Like, I didn't even think about that.
But I mean, there's, my friends at Flying Pigs Farms, they do sometimes use antibiotics on their pigs. You know, they raise rare breed pigs. But their argument is, we're a small farm. If I lose a pig, then that's a big loss out of our pocket. So we do sometimes use it. That's why they don't go for being organic. But although they raise a really good, well-raised, happy pig, that's delicious, but they do sometimes use antibiotics.
Right. Well, I mean, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about the whole like buzzword label of organic. Yeah. And it's like a lot of the stuff that you get is actually that's labeled organic isn't actually treated as well as a lot of the smaller farm things that, those.
Sure, there's also a lot of large farms that are trying to be organic but they're doing other things that,
But they have the money to jump through the hoops to get the stamp, when these other littler guys can't afford to do that, but they're actually, much more organic in a real sense,
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the future of food. Jack, you told me the Arancini brothers were on this.
Yeah, they were on Hot Grease. I love those guys.
I really love those guys, too, and what I love about them, they have a little shop here at the end of Bogart.
Oh, really?
I believe, yep, on Flushing. And they make, these Sicilian fried rice balls with meats in them. Mm-hmm. And I do kind of think that's the future of food, because I've just got to think that these rivers of youth coming out of the colleges and universities in this country, a lot of them are going to flock to
fried
just
rice
open
balls stuff with meat.
Yeah, in Cleveland and in Cincinnati, and another one might do pork buns, and another dogs.
I'm going to jump in on this real quick because it's very interesting, right? This is one of my theories. It's like every culture has a burrito. Right? But every culture has a fried rice ball stuffed with meat, too. This is like a classic, if not a fried rice ball, like a steamed rice ball. The Chinese have the lotus leaf wrapped. It's like steamed rice with meat. They do that in Indonesia as well. You go to any Spanish, bakery place, they're going to have, rice ball or mashed potato balls fried stuffed with meat. It's like a classic, eat it with your hands, grab it on the street kind of food, just anything wrapped up like that. And it is great. It's delicious. And I love seeing stuff like
one.
That. Yeah, totally.
I mean, you don't a little hot sauce on it and you're good to go.
Yeah, they were, and dumplings, right? Every culture has a dumpling.
Dumplings.
For sure.
Do you want to play a clip? They were on Hot Grease,
I don't have a clip, but I just wanted to give them a shout out.
No, yeah, absolutely.
Shout out.
I'm really just looking for free rice balls.
Yeah. Aren't we all?
And then anything else? By the way, your Daily Bites have been great.
Thanks.
What a great thing. It's their minute-long entries into an issue, in the food world. And, they only last 60 seconds. Jack and Katie put them together. They're really just quality stuff. And your email was really good, too.
Thanks.
Tell us about it. What were its features?
It's just designed better. Andrea did an incredible job with the design, so no longer am I just trying to throw a bunch of pictures in an email.
And you talked about Jessica Harris, right? She did the first. That was your first
produced. Yeah, we
played
a clip of that last week. It's the first post-produced thing we've done, so looking forward to doing more of that.
And she's only going to do one a month, so sometime within the next 30 days, all our listeners should, hit play on her link. Because it's pretty intense stuff. Plus, she has 20 guests on each, show.
Just little clips, yeah. I mean, I think we're doing Puerto Rico or Jamaica next, which will be exciting.
Very cool. Yeah. Anything else then, Jack? Any other crazy stories before we take a break and go into the interview?
No, I think we're ready to go.
All right, let's take a break.
We've got some music from Au Revoir Simone, who were on Growing Good this past Thursday, so that's what we're going
to
play.
Let's say hello to Au Revoir.
Fairway Market.
has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries, they cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
God, Katie, she writes the stuff. She records the stuff. I mean, Jack, she might be employee of the week. You might have to give up your parking spot. Anyway, I'm really excited. We have Zach Kell and Shauna Pacifico.
Hello.
In studio. Welcome, guys. So do different neighborhoods have different cuisines? You have a restaurant by Columbia University on New York City's Upper West Side. Shauna, you've run a restaurant now in the Alphabet City, which is opposite end, almost as far as you could go, Lower East Side. So do different neighborhoods have different cuisines and clientele?
Go ahead.
Well, I'm in a unique position because I was down at Clinton Street Baking Company under Executive Chef Neil Kleinberg for the last 5 years or so. In the Lower East Side, very close to actually where Back 40 is. And in the last couple of weeks, I've recently moved up to our sister restaurant, Community Food and Juice on 113th and Broadway. Now, it's very different between the two restaurants, the type of food and the clientele that we get. But I feel like Community is kind of, or Clinton Street, sorry, is kind of an exception. As it started out as like a very neighborhood place, very hip, you know, all the Lower East Side people 10 years coming in. Now it's kind of turned into more of a destination restaurant. We get a lot of tourists and stuff coming in. So it's you know, things are very set down there, what we do, and we're famous for what we do, and we don't really vary from that. And
You can't change that.
Yeah, exactly.
Once you get in the guidebooks, you can't change it.
Yeah, it's locked in. It's a moneymaker. Yeah. There's no reason, you know, it's not broken, so we're not going to fix it. But Uptown is very, you know, we do a lot of similar things. We do the same brunch that we do downtown, but it's not as well known up there, you know. It's a totally different attitude, and there's a lot more fluctuation in the clientele base because it's so, like, Columbia-driven, you know. So you get these kids that come in, and then by the time they get used to it and become regulars, the next year they're out, and there's a whole fresh batch.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
It seems like an interesting pace. It's a little different. Like I said, I've only been there for 2 years, or 2 weeks, so I'm still kind of figuring out what people are looking for. You know, at this point, my goal is to just kind of rein the menu in and refine all the stuff that they've been making.
You need to start hunting down the professors.
Exactly.
That's who you got to make your regulars. They're going to stick around.
I think it would be interesting to have like language days. You're like, today the specials are Russian.
Yeah, right.
All in Russian.
Yeah.
No, I think that there is a difference between clientele. I mean, the second restaurant is opening soon in the old Savoy space down in Soho. And that's a completely different neighborhood than Avenue B and 12th Street. I mean, Avenue B and 12th Street,
they're separated by such a small distance, yet they're so different.
Oh, it's a 15-minute walk. But I mean, if you walk, I mean, it's a block away from Broadway and Prince. It's on Prince Street. And it's like an outdoor shopping mall, and everybody from all over the world that's visiting is down there shopping.
Yeah, you get like the broke artists and the LES, and then the super rich celebrities in Soho.
And in Manhattan, as you get further downtown, the area narrows even more. So you're close to the West Side, you're close to Chinatown.
Mm-hmm. It's just an island.
and it's so diverse. I'm kind of interested to see, because Back 40 is sort of successfully brought in the young professional, the 25 to 40 year olds.
How? Through the food?
Through the food, being casual. I mean, we opened at a time when the economy tanked and nobody wanted to eat at fine dining restaurants. And so all of a sudden, this casual restaurant that opened without trying to bank on the economy tanking, we became successful while other restaurants were closing, because you could come in and get a meal for $25, $35.
What were your go-to dishes during those times? I mean, would it be the hamburger?
The burger will always be the go-to dish there. I mean, you can go in and spend $95 a person at Back 40 to eat, or you can go in and spend $25 a person.
Now, let's say someone you really respect, like another chef, comes in and just orders the burger. Do you in the kitchen get disappointed?
No, usually I don't. I don't. If it's somebody that just wants to come in, sit at the bar and have a burger and just have a quick meal, I respect that, because that's what you want. If somebody's coming in and wants to try my food and wants to like sort of get an experience out of it, I'm like, don't get the burger. You're just going to fill yourself up and you're not going to be able to like enjoy anything else. So definitely, like, you know, when friends come in, friends from out of town, I'm like, you're not allowed to order the burger. It's a burger.
Like, we'll send you sliders at the end. Don't worry. I'll pack one up.
So I used to
do the same thing at Clinton Street with the pancakes. Yeah. You know, it's like whenever I had a friend come in, I would be like, listen, I know that's why you're here, but don't order them. We'll do minis at the end or something, you know. But
You're just going to fill up.
I'll make sure you try it. But yeah.
Well, see, brunch is also, I always find, the hard meal to send extra food to people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because brunch is all bready things. So when people come into brunch, I'm like, well, I guess I could send you something, but I'm going to stuff you.
Some corn dogs.
Yeah.
You're so stuffed.
Deep fried corn dogs. Here's some pretzel nuggets. Well,
that was the go-to send out dish at Clinton Street was the fried green tomatoes.
Fried green tomatoes,
But still, it's like, you know.
I mean, I have to mention the jowl nugget right now. I mean, that was a very, very unique. You've done something with the part of the pig that I've never seen anyone else do, and it's so delicious. It's basically a little, you know, jowl McNugget. And it's round, it's very tender inside, but it has a crisp outside. And it comes in this very medieval, sweet and sour kind of relish.
Medieval.
No, it is.
Jalapeno jam.
Yeah.
I braised the jowl nuggets in beer. They're cured for 4 or 5 days and then braised and then pressed and then cut, then breaded.
Do you do a house cure on them, or is it a
house cure? Yeah, and I get my jowl nuggets from this weird company called Heritage Foods. I don't know if you've heard of them.
Well, no, we're proud of it, but but that is like one of those types of foods where if all of a sudden tomorrow McDonald's decided to do that, Americans would instantly be eating it.
I think once they find out that it's pure fat, and it's not pure fat, it's the jowl. There's meat in there. It's sort of another set of bacon that's on the pig.
You'd have to disguise the name.
It's
a
just
little
bacon.
Bit, so,
yeah.
Well, no, I'm. Yeah, it's just it is. It's just guanciale, or face bacon. I like to call it.
Oh yeah, no, jowl bacon is amazing product. It's great.
Yeah, it's great.
It's delicious.
But you know, I've said it before. I love it. You know, I actually had my cousin in, and she actually heard the first radio show I did with you here, and she heard about you talking about the jowl nuggets. She's like, I'm so excited to try your jowl nuggets. I heard about it. And she's saying it. I realize that she doesn't understand what she's eating, even though she's saying jowl. She doesn't get it. And so we're sitting down eating together, and we're, you know, she's like, oh, this is it. She like clapping. She's like all excited because she heard me talk about it on radio. And then she eats it, and she's like, oh my god, it's so good, so good, so good. And I was like, she's like, what am I eating? I'm like, well, let's eat it first before I tell you. And she's like, well, what am I eating? I'm like, well, it's the cheek. It's the face of the pig. And she was like, I don't care, it was delicious. But
oh, good.
What's the difference? It's all muscle and tissues.
But for somebody who is not exposed to that, it's a different cut of meat. So
that's what the anchovy has to fight an uphill battle too. You know, you say anchovy, people are like, I do not like it.
No, but there's some great anchovy out there that's not gross and salty and overfishy, you know.
I actually have three cases of Serena, who works with me's father, is one of the best anchovy producers in Italy, and he's sending me three cases to kind of spread around, and I kind of want to bring in like a pallet or two, because his anchovies shouldn't even be called anchovies because they taste so different. Anyway, well, we've talked a lot about this the clientele, the cuisines, you know, things, kind of go-to dishes. I mean, I did want to ask, like, with the academics, do you have an academic local culture that is different in terms of information it requires from the waiters or, you know, promises of sustainability on the menu?
Not that I can really speak to from personal experience yet, because like I said, it's still very new up there, but it's definitely like people are definitely a lot more conscious about sustainable foods, about locally produced foods, and about like health conscious, you know, which has been a little bit of a challenge in the beginning, coming from Clinton Street, where it's like all we want to do is cover everything clarified butter and deep fry it. You know, that's what they love down there. Mm. It's all fried chicken, pancakes. You know, all the eggs, everything's cooked in clarified butter. I only put canola in the fryers down there.
It's very Paula Deen of you.
Yeah, totally. You know, to up here where it's like really like fried things don't sell, you know, and they want seared fish. Yeah, we have fries on the menu and beet chips and stuff like that, but like breaded and heavy stuff is not what the public really wants. We do like a rice bowl up there, which is organic steam brown rice with like julienne vegetables, and then you get a choice of a protein. We do like tofu, locally produced seitan.
Oh,
I'm trying to get on there.
Especially at lunch,
grilled
right?
chicken, grilled salmon. Yeah, and we sell like, you know, 50 of them a day. It's ridiculous, you know. But it's like, yeah, it's a huge, huge seller up there. So it's, you know, it's a little bit of a challenge. It's been interesting to kind of re-gear myself towards making things delicious that also aren't too heavy, coming from, you know, what I was doing for 5 years at Clinton Street.
So. Well, re-gear is a good transitional word because you guys are both having common, you know, beginnings. You're starting back 40 West.
Yes.
I love that. It's still east of Broadway, but it's being called West. But and then you are starting, you know, just new at this, you know, very successful, very large restaurant, Community Food and Juice, like one of the best, almost you could argue, way uptown, the only restaurant to go
yeah,
to.
Yeah, there's really nothing up there.
Where are you exactly?
It's 113th and Broadway.
So can you talk about the biggest hardship? Just it could be whatever, a silly detail with the plumber all the way to how to manage your sous chef. Like the biggest challenge of starting a new venture to you guys personally.
For, well, I would say for me, and I'm not quite in the space as much as he is. Our gas isn't even on yet, and I'm sure there'll be new challenges that'll come up. But for me, I found when I opened Back 40 was setting up the systems, right? So, like, after a year of working in a space, you know that the box of salt is always going to sit here. The first six months,
absolutely,
you're running around like a chicken without its head because you don't know where to set things. It's like, that's why, like, you know, opening a restaurant is so hard because it's like you have to figure it all out. It's like,
yeah,
how do I cook in my kitchen at home when it's a brand new kitchen? Like,
you don't know that you're going to need the turmeric 2 inches away from you every 5 minutes until you're like
hardest thing. And Back 40, the prep kitchen is in the basement and the kitchen's upstairs. This new space, we have three floors. We have a basement, which is like all where all the refrigeration is. The main floor, and then there's also a prep kitchen upstairs. So it's like,
I'm
in for a challenge. Like, hopefully I gain some good muscles.
Do you have an elevator?
Yeah.
Or a dumbwaiter? You need one of those.
So. Probably by the end of it. Yeah. So that's, to me, that I find that the hardest. And that's also where I find harder that when critics come in is because those first 6 months.
And that's when they come in, too.
And that's when, now it's so fast. They come in, they'll come in within the first 2 weeks.
Well, especially because you already have recognition with Back 40. Mm. So it's not like you have 6 months to kind of build a buzz. People are waiting for it.
And I also think the Times and publications do that so that they don't get a bad rep if the restaurant turns out to be bad. They'll say like, well, we were just there in the first week. So
well,
we couldn't
I actually think that they, I think it's all changed due to the internet and the speed of information and how fast it gets out. So, you know, if they're not doing it,
That's true.
You got Joe Schmo, you know, blogger over here who's came into the restaurant 10 times and he's got how many ever followers and he beat the New York Times critic to something.
Yeah, the Times sitting on top of it, you know. So, I'm gonna agree with you on that. I think systems definitely are the biggest issue with stepping into a new space, though, you know, Community has been there for four and a half years at this point. So a lot of that stuff is kind of nailed out, you know. But for me, it's really like, you know, stuff like the ordering and like the porter schedule, because I have nine porters and dishwashers
lucky
up there.
You.
So trying but just trying to figure out like who's supposed to work what day and how many days I need them there. And then like who's working too much.
Do they have a representative that communicates on behalf of all of them, or do you have to deal with?
No, I speak pretty good Spanish.
Okay,
so it's okay. No, but I mean, for me, it's like because you know, with your home, like you know, in your apartment, you know, you don't need a system for like, oh, I need toilet paper. Oh, we need dish soap. Like you just know where that is, and you have an eye on it, and you're used to being in your home, so you know when you need to pick it up. So ordering is similar, right? 5 years at Clinton Street, like I could do the ordering in my sleep at 7 a.m. from my cell phone without even going to the restaurant. And up here, it's like such a bigger place, such a bigger menu, so many different purveyors that I'm working with, just trying to lock all this in and making sure that I'm getting everything I need to keep the place going on a day-to-day basis is like consuming all of my time until I get it streamlined, right? Yeah. So it's trying to balance all those different things is really, I think, the biggest challenge.
Now, what about on the creative side? What is the process for introducing a dish that's either going to change an already established successful menu or create a new one?
Well, That's that. Well, for me, to create a dish, when I create a dish, it's usually something I feel like eating, or something I've eaten somewhere else that I'm like, oh, I can do this better, or I want to try to do it as well as this person has done it. And so that's kind of really just about my mood. Creating the new menu for the new space is sort of a challenge because I have a menu written, and in theory I think it's going to work, but it's really only going to work when it works in the space. So that's kind of going to be the challenge to see if, you know, what I can really do with the cooking equipment and the space and the manpower that I'll have there. So that'll change things.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that. It definitely has a lot to do with what I want to eat at the time. I've always had this kind of philosophy where, you know, anything at any given point in time should be appetizing. So whether it's like, you know, the piece of meat that comes in off the truck, it should look good and it should look appetizing when it rolls down the rack into my walk-in. It should look good when I'm grinding it. It should look good as a burger patty before I put it on the grill. It should look good while it's cooking, you know. Mm-hmm. So if I see my guys making something or I'm working on something and at any point I'm like, you know, that's not really, you know, maybe I can make that good, but it doesn't look good right now. I don't want it. Then I try to refine that. It's also interesting, you know, you were just talking about blogs about for like restaurant reviews. So I tend to get a lot of inspiration from that. You know, cause we have a fish of the day and a steak of the day every dinner. So every day I have to come up with a new thing for both of those, and I kind of rotate from like a big cachet that I've built up of dishes. But what I like to do is go and look at blog posts, you know, and I'll see something on a blog post that looks appetizing and might fit with me, and then without really, you know, digging into what it is too much to like replicate it, I just take that idea and then kind of do it the way I think it should be done, and usually I end up with something good. But it's, you know, almost always something that I want to eat, you know.
Yeah. Like I do something similar. When we have a lot of one ingredient, a lot of sunchokes, or I have a lot of pork belly or something, and you know, or anything or something weird, I'll just Google that word and see what comes up with it. And then I just get ideas from that. Not that I'm taking a dish from somebody else, but or you know, I just kind of start reading different cultural aspects of it. And so
I
can get kind of interesting.
You are a great, I mean, I love hearing the way, I love your food, Shauna, and I love hearing that you do that because it's funny. You know, so many chefs we interview are like, oh, it's from my grandmother. And blah,
blah,
blah.
I get
and
that,
I
too.
I know you get a lot of the grammar from that and the inspiration, but it's cool to hear that a chef can Google a word and then
completely be inspired. Just like, I mean, there's just so much on the internet you can find.
It's amazing.
And that, like, you know, I'll Google the simplest thing. But for example, I'm in tonight. I'm in a chili contest at the Chelsea Market.
Okay.
Run by, I forget what organization, but Dixon's Farm Stand Meats is heading this up. There's a bunch of great restaurants doing it. So I, just to like sort of get ideas of chilies, I Googled chilies. I know how to make chili.
Yeah.
But I Googled just to see what's out there. And
that might bring in a certain ingredient.
It might bring in a certain ingredient or a certain thought, or, you know, I look through cookbooks. Yeah.
This is very interesting with the whole ethnic thing, because you have a Brazilian background and you obviously have an Indonesian influence in some of your cuisine.
Yeah.
So what ingredients define you, and how do you reintroduce those foreign cultures into an American New York City system?
Well, I'd say that the two ingredients that, you know, as far as Indonesian cuisine goes, and even like a lot of my more American-inspired dishes that I do on the specials, are the sweet Indonesian soy sauce.
Oh, I love that stuff.
Yeah. And
you just dump that on everything. Truffle oil.
Yeah, totally. And sambal terasi, right, which is a chili paste. It's mainly Thai chilies and a roasted shrimp paste, right? So you cook like shrimp paste, shallots, garlic, tomatoes, and a bunch of Thai chilies, and you kind of fry them and cook them all down and puree them, and it makes this like crazy super spicy sauce. But it has a lot of complexity of flavor, you know, with the like lime juice and the shrimp paste and all these different things in it. So these two items are really great bases. So like if I'm doing like a curry coconut or something, I'll do curry paste, coconut milk, and the sambal. Or a marinade, I do like the sweet Indo soy sauce and the sambal for like fish marinades or like kind of a spicy barbecue kind of thing. I do that a lot, and it's like really great flavors, but they're good like base products to start with, and you can just add all kinds of things to them and it's delicious. So
for me, it's basically just recreating dishes that my mother made when I was a kid.
Like the cheese ball?
The pão de queijo.
Uh-huh.
That's a big one. I've done that many times. It's basically a, sort of like a gruyere, but like made out of cassava flour, Parmesan cheese, egg, and milk. And it's completely gluten-free, and it's good, and it sort of has... It's actually soured cassava flour, so it has like this sort of funky undertone to it. And some people that work with me are like, oh, this is so gross, but then other people are like eating 100 of them because they're like just little cheese balls. And trying to recreate that and sort of integrate it in not a forceful way. You know, at Back 40, we've definitely done feijoada, which is the national dish of Brazil with stewed black beans with all pig parts and blood sausage and jerky and all that stuff. And then I recently discovered this great pepper called the Kumari pepper. It's this wild little yellow pepper it's sort of spicy, but it's just really aromatic and delicious, and you can just buy it in these jars. And at one point, I was putting it on like 3 different things in the menu, and my sous chef was like, yo, calm down. I'm like, it's so good. So, it, you know, definitely. Now,
let me ask, if you could introduce 2 Brazilian dishes, like you were given a grant by the Brazilian consulate to have, you would be paid $1 million to introduce 2 Brazilian dishes to bring attention to them. Ones that you think Americans could embrace, restaurants could embrace. Like, what would you think is the best gateway into Brazil?
Well, one would be feijoada, to really introduce that into the culture, because I think it's a great dish to really use crazy parts of meat that in it really flavors them well. And the other one would be bobó de camarão, which is basically shrimp cooked. You know, there's a whole, I mean, Brazil's a really, really big country, and there's a whole part of the Brazilian cuisine that I haven't even tapped, which is like the African influences and that kind of stuff. And they do use a lot of dried shrimps and shrimp paste and those kind of things that I still, where my parents are from, my family's from, they don't use a lot. But bobó de camarão is just regular shrimp. It's cooked with coconut milk and chilies and spices, and you eat it with rice. And there's different regions that do it slightly different, but it's really, really good.
Well, I'll tell you, the best dessert in the world, so few people make because it requires so many eggs and so much time, is a Brazilian dish called quindim. K-I-N, new word, D-I-N. I don't know why that more people don't make that, because it's so...
I know the word, and I know that I can envision it, but I don't remember what it tastes like.
Even the great Brazilian restaurants, you know, the last ones, you know, or not even great, just the ones that remain don't do it because it's just too time intensive. Well, it's been very, very interesting interview. Let's take a brief break, and we'll come back for the final 10 minutes.
Great.
Sounds good.
Like lullaby music, huh?
Well, main course is about to get serious.
That's right.
No, we are sponsored by Fairway Market, by the way, and Steve Jenkins remains always one of the best friends of the network, and they're so successful, Fairway. I mean, they just keep opening in new places, you know, and just bringing good food to, you know, communities that might have not had so much choice. So anyway, we love that Fairways sponsored us.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
My aunt, who's Brazilian, is on Facebook, and I said, please listen, and she talking about the dessert that you were just talking about. She's like, it's like pudding.
Yes.
Wow.
Which I think is really cute that she's listening in Florida.
She is. That means the live stream's working.
Hi, Chia.
Cross that off your to-do list.
Yes.
That is awesome. You know, it's like a very hard flan.
Yeah.
And it's flan. And it has, but it has that little thick, moist pie crust at the bottom, you know? So you get the bread, but you also get this egg pudding. Oh, it's just so delicious. So this has been a great show. By the way, we have in studio Mia, who is part of the Indonesian influence. So I wanted to ask you guys, what food issues concern you most on the national level? What food issues, like, just thinking about, you know, reading the news, watching TV, personal musings?
Awareness, for sure. One of the things that always really gets me is there's stuff like the slow food movement, you know, which is a great thing in theory, but has just kind of become about, like, rich white people having dinner parties. And, you know, stuff like that I think would be really great to get back to more of a grassroots movement to make good, real, local food accessible to the masses, to the uneducated, not just, you know, about people being a little pretentious.
Well, I would like to spin on that a little bit. I think it's really about educating people in other towns about, and not educating in a snobby way, like, oh, you don't eat local, so you don't understand, but to really get them to understand what, you know, buying from a local farm can do for the community, for their bodies, for the deliciousness of the meal.
Well, I'm surprised that no powerful chef, I mean, tell me if there's another. Danny Meyer seems like the closest guy with his Shake Shacks opening in downtown Brooklyn and stuff. But I mean, has any chef who's done very well opened like a string of pork bun stations or hot dog stands or hamburger carts, like in you know, even as a, with the break-even goal, you know, not as a huge revenue stream, but in terms of really introducing this into communities that really have no access?
Not that I know of. Omaha. I mean, I don't really like keep up with that. I'm sure there are in these, you know, cities and other states that there are people sort of following the movement. I mean, there's definitely all these great TV shows that are out that are getting people more interested in food. But it's still hard for me. You know, I love New York, but when I think about if I ever leave New York, where am I going to live? I don't want to live somewhere where I have to eat Olive Garden. You know, and that's my choice.
Just cook at home a lot more.
But I don't want to have to, you know, and I feel like those things, you know, those corporations have the money to expand and to get people interested in their food, and they have the money to buy up the real estate. Smaller guys don't, and so it's a much more uphill battle for them.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Well, very interesting. So anything on the menu that people should know about? I mean, when they come into community after listening to this show, our listener base, which includes my mom, possibly only my mom. No, what should she be coming
and my aunt.
Eating a community? And your aunt is like, I'll be there in 4 weeks.
I mean, well, right now, like I said, our popular...
What would you wish someone ordered for dinner? Dream order.
I tell everyone to get the fish of the day. I mean, it's really, you know... But that's just me, because everything else I'm kind of refining and I'm working on and it's still new, you know. But I know that I have complete control over what the catch of the day is going to be and what it's going to be paired with. And I put a lot of effort into making that really, really good right now. Not to say that anything else on the menu is bad, but it's like it's not – it doesn't all have my influence yet, you know. That's the one thing that's really got my influence. But – you know, other than that, there's really nothing on the menu that I don't like. Okay. So I just like to see people come in and get excited about things that are going on. You know, I want them to really enjoy it, and I want their feedback if they don't. So,
it's hard for me to say for the new space.
Can't you say anything about it?
I will tell you that we have a smoker.
Okay.
That's the only thing I can say.
Who made it?
I don't know. actually. I don't. I can see the name in my head, but I'm not sure. I wasn't really involved in purchasing or checking out smokers. Peter Hoffman did all that, but I, you know, so that's kind of an exciting thing. And it's sort of, it'll for me also be a challenge, because I think that smoked things can be too much, and now I have this giant piece of equipment that I have to do some smoke things in, and learning how to balance that out.
What would you imagine could be a dinner time order, like a good order?
Well, what I'm hoping is that we'll be buying lots of pork shoulders from you, and that people will want to come in and eat a whole pork shoulder between six people, slow roasted or slow smoked, and with some pita bread and some good sauce.
Good pita bread.
Housemade, you know, grilled pita bread.
People don't copy things that should be copied. Like the way they do it on Atlantic Avenue or at the Rio, good, those puffy balls, you know.
Oh, well, I don't know how to make that. But I'll think about it for when you come in.
Sorry.
I'm a no, big but fried like it's fan. Just
you know, the, just the ones that are like all air. And
yeah, the puris, right? The fried.
Oh man! Because it's like you're eating the inside of bread. It yeah. has that doughy white, yeah, just yeah, mushy, yeah, yeah. But it's still a very thin pita. It's amazing.
Yeah. What's that? What's that? The Malaysian dish, y'all? The curry chicken with the fried. Yeah, roti canai. That's a good one.
Roti canai.
Oh yeah, no, I like that.
Yeah, same kind of doughy, fried, puffy thing. But
the
with
Indian
like
breads are
chicken.
Good too. That way, thin, but yeah. you know, they taste like a thick.
Yeah, and there's lots of great loaf. Breads that you can make that don't require a bread baking oven or that kind of stuff.
Deep
there's
fryers.
Some. Yeah, deep fryers, grills, flat tops. You can definitely do some interesting things. So, and that kind of, you know, I'm excited to see, you know, and this restaurant will have some large communal tables to get, you know, big groups of people to come in and share food and eat with their hands and eat, you know, sort of kind of get in the more carnal side of eating again. I'm hoping that goes mm-hmm. that direction.
Well, what a great show. I mean, I hope the listeners have really enjoyed this. By the way, out of the 25 shows, this is the worst one. So listen to the other 24.
You've only done 25? Yeah.
There are 24 other great shows, better shows on this network. If you're not subscribed to our newsletter already, you should be. HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Jack Inslee, great job.
Oh,
Jack,
thanks.
Are you still awake?
I'm still here.
Thanks for engineering and producing and
I'm trying to come up
station.
With a list of five people I can take for that pork shoulder.
Jack, have we arrived at our 9 millionth Facebook like?
We are on 1,000.
Okay.
Not quite.
Almost.
Getting close.
Stay tuned till Straight No Chaser when we might break the record. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.